Audi.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. It's me, Lisa. We're still in lockdown here in London, as we probably will be for a while, by all accounts. I was meant to go to Spain this week, and I'm pretty devastated I'm not going. I mean, obviously, there's bigger things at stake than holidays, but I know that the people who love travelling amongst us will be feeling the sting a little bit. And, you know, that's okay. It's okay to be annoyed and upset and frustrated about not going places. And it doesn't mean you're not worried about the world and the health of the people you care about and everything. I don't think the two things are mutually exclusive. In terms of what we're doing here at the podcast, we're carrying on as normal. I did last week talk to a couple of people in lockdown in Madrid and also in Connecticut. And I might be doing that again, speaking to some other people around the world, just because it's kind of interesting to know what other people and other podcasters and journalists and radio presenters and just people that I know really might be doing around the world. But I do have a good few episodes in the bag here and recorded a few weeks ago, all of them now. So that brings me on nicely to today's guest. Reporting on wildlife conservation, threats to ecosystems and fragile cultures from remote corners of the world is travel writer Sophie Roberts' passion. She cut her journalistic teeth with Jessica Mitford, the famous writer, then ditched an enviable job at Condé Nast Traveller to tell stories often not told. She's diced with danger in Papua New Guinea, protected elephants in Chad, fallen in love with the forests and people of the Congo, and for her debut book, she crossed the wildest parts of Russia in her quest to tell the fascinating stories of the lost pianos of Siberia. Sophie Roberts is on the Big Travel Podcast.
I've been looking through your book and it sounds like an incredible adventure. A lot of research has gone into it. Why don't you start off by, yes, telling me who you are, and then we'll go into a little bit about the book.
Great. My name's Sophie Roberts. I'm a travel writer, journalist. I'm not a musician and I'm not a historian, but I am a traveller and a really passionate one. I'm British. I was brought up in Scotland. My father's of American descent and my mother's of Irish descent, so I've always been slightly rootless in the places where I've lived. But I was brought up in a rural place. My father was fish farming, and so I was always used to occupying my own time. I've always been a reader, and I've always had a huge lust to kind of see what was on the other side of a pretty empty horizon. And I didn't go away until I was 15. I went to France, where I had an uncle living there, and then I didn't step into anywhere further than France until I was 18, which was my first big trip. And that was when all the worlds that I'd imagined in books and had hungered to visit began to become alive, if you like. So that was the beginning of my commitment, passion and obsession for
travel.
Do
you think the impetus came from the world of your imagination, the world that you'd created through reading so many books?
Yeah, definitely. I think books are a really, really powerful transporting power, and for sure. But it also, what I found when I was on the road is that there are so many stories that aren't told. And that was the great privilege of journalism, is that you get given a free ticket to ask questions that other people don't have the same license to. You can cut through conversations much quicker and find a common point and a sense of humanity with a greater speed and ease. And that to me is the privilege of being a travel journalist, not just a traveller.
So what was that first trip, the 18-year-old trip?
That was to India. My grandfather had left me enough money to get a ticket, so I went to India. And it was at a time when India is now, it's a highly commercial tourism experience and pretty expensive. But back then I could do it on $1 a day, $2 a day. And it was great. To me, it was a lot of the cliches for sure, but it was also... I felt very safe there as a woman. I found my confidence as a single female traveller. I'm quite tall and I felt really comfortable. And that gave me confidence, I guess. And it also gave me fed romance. It fed this interest I have in the extremes of society and culture, not just either the oppressed or the elite.
I think India is, it can be hard work. It's incredibly beautiful, but it can be hard work, especially as an 18-year-old. Or do you think because an 18-year-old with quite wide eyes, you were able to adapt?
Yeah, I think I like travel that reminds you how to feel. So sensation in the truest sense of the word. What are your senses? Your taste, your hear, your smell, everything. And India stimulates that in a really pretty profound way. And it's something I've found in all the work that has excited me since. If I go into, and I've had periods of my life where I've had to earn my living writing about smart hotels. And there was
sounds
one...
Sounds awful.
It sounds awful, but just to make a point is I was in one room in the South Pacific. It was exquisite. It was a place Hollywood people go and spend a lot of money. But it was also one of these hotels that was so technologically advanced, the windows don't open. And it was so eco-perfect. The air conditioning system meant that it was hermetically sealed. And I lay in bed in this room thinking, oh my goodness, I can see the palm swaying. I can see the waves crashing. And the next time I'm not going to be able to smell or hear those things, I'm going to be hermetically sealed in my own coffin. So it's, to me, you have to really feel a place. That's what gets the blood going. And while we all travel for different reasons, and I respect the fact that sometimes you just want to lock out the world and go into yourself, I'm more of an extrovert. I want the blood to flow a little bit faster through my veins from the act of travel.
I can really relate to that. I mean, I have been lucky enough to do a lot of luxury travel for work, and you do feel closed off from the world, that you're not getting that cacophony of noises that you would be in India, you know, the sights and sounds and the smells of the streets and the cooking. If you're in this beautiful five-star hotel, lovely as it is, I'm not complaining. I like both those things.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's a version of paradise that is a version of paradise. But I find myself I've done a job on a cruise ship, but I always found myself pulled into the bowels of the ship, where the guys that are working on the ship, where their conversations are more direct, genuine, their stories are more human than the ones on the top floor, where it's more polite and where the experience is polished. That, to me, is one version, a very relevant version of travel to people that need that break from reality, whereas I want to travel in order to engage with reality, if that makes sense.
So I'll do this chronologically, because I really can't wait to get onto your book, but I'm going to pace myself, because you're 18, you go travelling to India. What happens next?
I trained as a journalist, and I worked for a while for a brilliant lady. She was one of the Mitford sisters, called Jessica Mitford, and she was doing a revision of her 1963 bestseller, The American Way of Death. So I spent some time learning the techniques of investigative journalism, if you like, and she gave me a lot of confidence and encouraged me to get some training. So I did. I studied in America. I studied journalism, and it gave me the rule book, if you like, which was really important. I then got my first job. I was really lucky. I got my first job at a magazine that was launching here in the UK under an editor I'd made tea and coffee for at some point in a British newspaper, and it was called Condé Nast Traveller. And I was on the launch team for that. And it was an exciting time, and it was completely new to me. me because I'd really never stayed at a smart hotel in my life. It wasn't part of my history, my family, or frankly, the kind of any kind of relationship with the background I came from. But it was exciting. But it was also, I realized being in an office, reading about other writers' travels was kind of like being stabbed in the heart, you know? So I handed in my notice when I was 2 years in, and I went in on a Wednesday, and my editor said to me, he said, why are you coming in on a Wednesday? And I said, because it's my two-year anniversary. And it was the promise I'd made myself that I would learn the ropes and do my apprenticeship under some brilliant, brilliant mentorship, because those editors were phenomenal. But then I had to take the risk and go free. And I wasn't earning a huge amount, so the loss of that was not a big deal. I just had to get out in the world and do my own reporting, so that's what I did.
I don't want to go down too much of a rabbit hole with it, but working for Jessica Mitford, wow, I mean, that is quite a significant job. I mean, she's such a, you know, her and her family. I mean, she's the non-fascist one, isn't she?
Yeah, yeah,
she's
the left. The
yeah, Decca, she was known
Decca,
as.
Decca, yeah,
one,
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
She's the non-fascist one, which is good. She was very left-leaning.
She was brave.
Spain, didn't she? Yeah. When she was very young, to help fight the civil war, as a lot of left-leaning people did.
Yeah, she was really, really brave. And it's funny how she taught me about risk. And she also had I still have all the correspondence. I must give it to the family, in fact. But she did all her correspondence written, no email. It was just, so I've got this collection of letters and faxes, including letters and faxes sent three ways with her sister, who was the Duchess of Devonshire. And she was just, I mean, what I learned from her was risk and bravery are important, and a moral conviction is really important. And, you know, she passed away after, I think I'd worked for her for about a year, but it was a precious moment. It was inspiring. You know, she was an icon to me as a writer and a free thinker. But it's funny because this book I've done on Siberia, it's really extraordinary. Her son is one of the world's great piano tuners. So he helped me understand the mechanics of an instrument of which I had no understanding when I set out on this particular project.
Well, the book is something we're going to get to pretty much in the next two questions, okay? So, because the book is phenomenal and very travel-focused, but travel highlights after you left Condé Nast, before you write the book.
So I had to do a lot of bread and butter earning, so I did a lot of hotel work, to be honest. I mean, that's the commerce of being a travel writer has changed. You can no longer write great poetic pieces about finding I myself and someone else in some lost desert. You know, you have to earn your money writing about smart hotels in the Maldives. So I did that for a period of time, but I suppose something happened when I started going closer and closer to the edge, by which I mean a lot of people are in the space that I belong to. There's a lot of travel writers out there. So how do you distinguish yourself? And I like to do it through collaboration. So working with brilliant photographers, and it opens up a whole new way of looking at the world. So finding those collaborations became critically important. And the other thing was stepping into the areas where there was fear. And that meant beginning to move into those areas that are sort of marked up red on the map. Because there is still something worth recording, reporting, seeing, feeling, and understanding. So while never to gloss over political horror or human rights issues or conservation crises, I still think journalists need to go into those areas to look for another side to the narrative. And that became very important to me. So I suppose a sort of key trip was probably Chad. I went to Chad, it was in 2015, and I was working in the south, and I was one of the first journalists in to report on this incredible work that they were doing to using tourism and the money from tourism and the attention and positive energy that comes from tourism to help tell the tale of a remarkable turnaround story with elephant conservation there. And that is still flying well and high, and it's amazing. You know, these elephant herds in Chad in 2015, the matriarchs, the mother elephants, would circle the baby elephants in like a whirlpool to protect them from firing of AK-47. And that was how the behavioural patterns had changed. And now the elephants no longer whirlpool. they are settled, they feel safe because of the extraordinary work by an organisation called African Parks. So to go in there as a witness to change has been really exciting. And also to Chad is not somewhere that should necessarily be at the top of every bad list. I've just come back again from Chad, from the Ennedi Desert in the north, which again is marked heavily red on the map. But there's another narrative that needs telling.
So what is the situation in Chad? I know nothing about Chad, I have to admit.
Well, you don't want to be a woman in Chad. It's incredibly poor and it's got huge challenges, and those should not be underestimated. But the other side of it is it's got amazing territory. These up in the north, the Ennedi Desert and Tibesti, these mountains are like, it's like going into a set from Star Wars, and there's no one there apart from a really ancient nomadic culture and some of the oldest rock art in the world. Extraordinary rock art. There was one that I encountered which was a rhino, which would speak to the rhino possibly, very possibly, once being endemic in that area. And so it tells a story of human history. It tells stories of shaman history. It tells stories of a very, very old Africa in a place that no one goes to.
Well, we love stories on the podcast. So what's your Chad story? What was the most fascinating, interesting standout moment from that trip to the desert?
How big the world still is, I think. It's even kind of, the story is still to be published in the Financial Times, but how reaffirming it is that there are some new things under the sun. That's exciting. And that sort of sense of optimism is really important to the work I do. Travel is a real force for good in so many ways. It's a force for good economically, it's a force for good philosophically, and it creates connections between people. And it's getting a hard time at the moment because of climate change, because of this terrifying virus, but it can be a real force for good. And I felt that for so many reasons in Chad.
It's conflicting, isn't it, with the whole environmental issue? And it's something that we've been facing head on this podcast, speaking to my friend Lucy Siegel, who's a passionate advocate for environmental issues. Do you think somewhere like Chad will be opening itself up to tourism? I see more and more people going on excursions in what would have previously been no-go areas, and people being a lot more adventurous with their travels. And obviously tourism is a double-edged sword, but you know, it does bring some positive things.
It's a niche market. It's going to be a niche market. And my business is not necessarily to manage other people's risk. I take my own risk and I make good research about it, and then I write about it. And it's up to the individual whether they choose to go or not. I mean, the other place where I've worked quite a lot is the Congo and the DRC. It's full of risk. Will it open up to tourism more than it is now? Yes and no. The masses are never going to go in there. But people who are interested in the issues, who are travelling, and that I think is becoming a more pronounced strand of the travelling public, is people are travelling towards issues. They want to understand them. They want to connect. They want to be moved. They are more aware of how they can contribute to conservation or to women's rights, whatever it might be. And if that means taking some measured risk to go into these places, then it's worth it.
Do you ever feel threatened? I mean, you are tall, blonde, blue-eyed, clearly British or European.
I do and I don't. I mean, I'm careful. I was given some very good advice, which was never go into a situation which you don't know the way out of. And so I am always really aware of where the door is in the room, so to speak. I had one case. I have to think on my feet, and sometimes you have to use your gender to your advantage and not pretend it's not there. So I was in Russia. I was in the far north in Russia. I was in the Yamal Peninsula up in the Arctic. And I was staying with an indigenous group of people, and out of nowhere, I mean, this is a remote area, out of nowhere, about 20 snowmobiles turned up with men, Russian men, big Russian men, big strong Russian men who wanted a drink. And they came in, they walked into this sort of encampment that I was, and they wanted to do toasts, and I knew and could feel where this was going. And the community I was with sort of scattered, and I was with 20 big, tough Russian men. And they were, we toast. And I stood up and I took my cup of vodka and I put my hand on my belly and I said, I'm going to drink to my child. And I wasn't pregnant. I'm way beyond those years. But they stood down and they were so respectful. They showed me to my my tent where I was sleeping, and they couldn't have been more charming. And so that was a case where I had to think on my feet, and it helped me. But yeah, sometimes it's difficult. I've had tricky times. Papua New Guinea is tricky, very tricky, as a woman. But like I say, I don't travel foolishly. I know my way out.
What's the deal with Papua New Guinea? I haven't been there either. These countries you've been to, and I just sort of feel like I'm lying on a beach somewhere.
No, Papua New Guinea, I lay on a beach.
You do?
Yeah, it has beaches too. Papua New Guinea, I find really interesting. You know, I was one of the first stories I did there was in the Sepik River, and it was a traveller who was a real influence to me, a guy called Mark Shan, who'd done a trip in West Papua, and a river journey, and I wanted to go into a place where the phones didn't work, and just kind of, there was a particular reason, there was a particular indigenous group I wanted to go up, and how did I find it? It's fierce. You can move 2 miles upriver, and the indigenous groups speak different languages. It's hard. The position of women is really hard. I saw and heard things I never wish to see or hear again, including a rape. You know, it's a hard culture. But there are things to understand in visiting it. I fell in love with the Solomon Seaside of Papua, where there is a kind of, there's a different groups there. There are amazing bits of history. It's hard to travel. The logistics are hard. There's not a lot of roads. You know, they've got a lot of helicopters because the oil and gas industries, etc. But there's not a lot of roads. I found it. I think I've been there 3 times now. I like it, but it's, you know, it's not an easy narrative.
So I think we should get on to Siberia. You're not a musician, but you've been fascinated by the history and integral culture of pianos and how they got to Siberia. I know nothing about the piano, the whole piano-Siberia connection.
Well, it's an odd one. There's no reason why you should, because it's a strange coming together of some ideas. Well, basically, the genesis of the book, The Lost Pianos of Siberia, does not actually begin in Russia. It begins in Mongolia, which is a place I love. I've been many times. I have 2 children, and we go there as a family. And there's a particular valley called the Orkhon, which is about 8 hours' drive outside the capital, Ulaanbaatar. And in this valley, there is a family, a German gentleman and a Mongolian wife, and they've got 3 kids. And the youngest daughter was learning piano. And her teacher was a brilliant musician, a concert musician, who would come out for 2 or 3 weeks to teach. And she was playing there in the summer of 2015 on a grand piano. It was a Yamaha piano. It was nice sound. But the German, as she was playing some Bach, leant over to me and said, oh, how I long for her to have one of those lost pianos of Siberia. And he threw that phrase out to a storyteller for a reason. It stuck. It stuck so hard that when I went back out to Russia on an assignment about a tiger conservationist, I started to dig. And what I discovered was this extraordinary connection between piano fever in Russia in the early 19th century, Moscow and St. Petersburg. And it spread out of those kind of glittering diamond-filled salons across the Ural Mountains into Siberia. The pianos traveling with governors, governors' wives, noble exiles, misfits and mavericks. And, you know, these are instruments that were carried to Siberia on the backs of sledges. And that absurdity and romance kind of piqued my interest. So I started to look for a piano for this Mongolian concert pianist. And it led me on a kind of extraordinary, I think I spent 158 days on the road in Russia. My Siberia was from the Ural Mountains all the way to the Pacific. Siberia isn't quite a place, it's more of an idea. And I went by Anton Chekhov's description. He traveled Siberia in the 1890s, which is Siberia begins in Ekaterinburg, the city in the Urals, and ends goodness knows where. And the goodness knows where was my poetic license. So, yeah, all the way to Kamchatka, the Commander Islands, the Kurils. It was really exciting.
Tracking down pianos.
Yeah, tracking down pianos in crazy places. And, you know, where they washed up and how they arrived there. And more importantly, the people that protected them and continue to love and adore these instruments. Not because they've got a beautiful sound. You know, music historians would be appalled by some of the pianos that I found so endearing. But the fact that someone cared, against all odds, you know, Russia has a really, really traumatic history. So those pianos allow me to tell the story of kind of human solace in times of darkness.
What's the most unusual place or situation you found one of those pianos in?
Right at the beginning of my search, I was sent a photograph of a piano in a volcanic caldera with a little gathering. I think there was about 10 or 11 people listening to a piano in Kamchatka, which is so cool. Kamchatka sticks out into the Pacific. There's no road connecting it to the rest of Russia. On the board game Risk, it's the best place to make an attack on North America. It's got 500 volcanoes down this crazy ridge. It's so fire and ice. And the fact that a piano had been brought into one of these kind of calderas in the back of beyond as a sort of natural amphitheatre for the performance speaks to the way the eccentricity of the whole thing, but also the way that piano culture runs through Russian society like blood. You know, it's there in a really highly educated way that maybe has been lost in my own country.
But you were sent the photo, and did you go
I was sent
there?
The photos,
did you track
yeah,
it down?
Yeah. I was sent the photo, and what I did was I tracked down the gentleman who sent it, and I went to visit him. I went to Kamchatka, I think, twice in the end, and together we looked for a particular instrument. There was a wonderful instrument that was brought to Kamchatka in the 1930s, which was the gentleman that brought it said at the time it was the equivalent of taking a piano to the moon. And that led back into other stories. An amazing piano that was taken to the wife of the governor of Kamchatka in a very early 19th century. And that took possibly the longest journey of any piano that I found, because it didn't go overland. It was too forbidding. It went around the horns. So it did a proper circumnavigation of the world to get to Kamchatka on the other side.
What other lost pianos stick out?
Well, the broken ones, there's so many. I was very interested by a piano I found in a small village outside of a city called Tomsk, which was acquired for the price of a bag of potatoes. So, and that was a wonderful grand piano, a sort of late, I think it was early 19th century, late 19th century, that was a good one. And there's one, you know, I think pianos that the travellers would enjoy is there's a wonderful piano in Irkutsk. It's a well-known piano, which belonged to a princess called Maria Volkonsky, who her husband was banished as a revolutionary in 1825, I think it was, as one of the Decembrists. And she went out to join him in prison. And she dragged behind her on the back of a sledge across a frozen Lake Baikal this piano wrapped up in furs. And it was a clavichord. And then as she settled after their hard labour sentences were up, shackled to jails, she had another piano delivered, a Lichtenthal, which you can find in a beautiful museum in the city of Irkutsk. So it's full of mad sort of stories. Well, often what's missing as well, I think it's important, often what's missing tells just as big a story as what you find. So some of the pianos, I didn't find the actual object, but in seeking the possibility, I opened up people and stories and place. And that's what kind of, going back to the beginning of our conversation, that's why I travel. And it is ultimately allows you to find some empathy with somebody who otherwise, you know, I remember when I first started this, The Economist ran a cover with Putin with the devil's eyes. I know it's a very iconic cover, it's a brilliant cover. But I thought to myself, that may be true, but there's got to be another narrative.
And there is indeed.
Yeah.
It reminds me a little bit about there's a book called The Social Life of Things and the social history that objects have. And that might be, you know, the table that you've inherited, or it might be the table that was made, you know, in post-war austerity and why it was made in that style and why that style suddenly became fashionable. But this, you know, music is so important to many people, and this social life of the pianos, the social history, is just really fascinating. I can see how you got pulled into that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a book that was a real influence to the project. Was one called Hair with the Amber Eyes by Edmund Duval, and he follows an object to tell the biography of his family. And he had a line in it which is something like, objects will always be lost and stolen and retrieved and bought. It is how you tell their stories that matters. And that gave me, again, a sort of, I read those lines and I thought, that gives me license to travel a bit differently. You know, so much of Siberian travel writing has been dominated by, you know, how tough am I in an extreme climate? And I wanted to move on from that because we live in the age of tourism. So it's not really about how tough anymore, because there's always a helicopter, a flight, a satellite phone, and an emergency Medicare system, even in remote Russia. So how do you tell a modern travel narrative in a remote place that is less about the I and more about the them, so the people that you're among? That's what I really wanted to do.
How do you combine this remote travel, which must happen for quite long periods at a time, with your children? And I'm not just asking you this because you're a woman. I do ask this of men. However, the male explorers I often have on have actually not managed to get married and have children, particularly the lovely Leveson Wood. We had a chat about him, and I know he gave a lovely quote on the dust jacket of your book. But we had a chat about one thing he hasn't managed to do is he's missed that, because he's been away so much. He's obviously still young and he still might do, but he's missed out a certain amount of social life at home. You do have kids and you are doing these big exploratory travels.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough. But I am really fortunate. I met my husband when I was 17, so he kind of helped make the monster, if you will. Like, he always encouraged it. He's a big traveler himself. You know, he works in the expedition industry, and I have always packed my children in my bags whenever I could. So, you know, they've traveled to Siberia. We've camped. We spent 3 weeks camping up the shores of Lake Baikal. My younger son came with me to Papua New Guinea. I really, really want them to see the world. And, you know, being a travel writer is never going to make you rich, but if it can enrich my children, then I'm going to do everything I can to sneak them in. They're Mongolia too. It's really important. So, but that's not to underestimate the fact, yeah, sometimes I'm away for 3 weeks, and this particular project in Russia was really tough on all of us, but it's what you get used to, and it's also my kind of honest truth is, I've got a really strong family, and my parents live nearby, and my sister lives nearby, and my husband works from home, and that makes it possible. I absolutely would not have been able to do it otherwise.
And there's different ways of being rich, aren't there? Talking about travel writing not making you rich.
No, it doesn't make you rich, but it is
rich in experiences.
Oh yeah, and it's I love the fact that my children know where Chad is on the map, you know. That makes me really proud. I love the fact that when Trump publishes his no-go list, I get a call from a brilliant American editor who says, those are your assignments for the next year. You know, that's what I love. It's got nothing to do with how I'm going to buy a Louis Vuitton bag.
So where are your next assignments?
I'm up in the air at the moment. I've got something that might be happening in Socotra, which is tricky.
In where, sorry?
Socotra, which
is
off the coast of Yemen. So I'm struggling with what the real return is in a place that's going through humanitarian catastrophe. But there is also a very, very important environmental story that needs telling there. Because when the world's eyes are averted because of conflict and the rest, ecological devastation can happen. I want to see what's there. It's a very, very important area for kind of endemic species of various kinds. What other assignments have I got coming up? I want to be able to do some more work in the Congo. I fell in love with the Congo last year. I was working up in Odzala, up in the north in the forest there. And there's some really brave people doing some really great stuff. And it's a stimulating environment, so I quite want to do some more work there.
Just thinking for a moment back to Siberia, how do you get around Siberia? I know about the railway, but how else do you get around?
Yeah, the railway is great, and it's like a thread that runs right through it. But it is just, and it tends to be the thing most people experience. But it is by no means the only way, or nor should it be the only way to experience Siberia, because when you go off that thread, it gets really exciting. You travel opportunistically. You know, I was hitching rides with oil and gas workers. I've used dog sleds around Baikal, which is more touristic but great fun. I've used a hovercraft to cross the lake in winter. I've used a Russian research vessel to kind of go down the coast. And I love the fact it hasn't been processed into just a tourism buy it off the shelf experience. It's opportunistic, and it kind of puts the zest back into this, how am I actually going to get there by the end of the day challenge, which we've kind of lost in modern culture. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. The journey used to be part of the experience,
yeah,
didn't it? And now it's just like, let's get the airport done, you know. But people more and more are thinking of other ways to travel.
Yeah.
Train journeys, long train journeys, which I absolutely love for coming back, because we've all got to think about the way we travel,
yeah,
and its impact on the environment.
Yeah. Somebody said something to me brilliantly. It was a therapist who was talking to me about why I travel and the speed, and am I running away from something or running towards something? And she said to me, brilliant line, it's like, you've got to learn to watch the trees moving past. And it's really true. Travel should be about sitting back, not filling it with iPhone junk, not constantly stimulating yourself so you don't actually have time to absorb and process. So watching the trees moving past is going to become a really important part of the travel I hope to do, where I slow down, I do use more trains, and I allow for the spaces in between for something to happen rather than constantly seeking the quick hit.
And also it's a great title for your next book.
Oh, yeah, I like that.
Isn't it?
Can I steal
it's
that?
Really nice, yeah. You heard it here first. Right, I'm going to ask you my last question. My last question is always about music, and you're not a pianist. And did you not get the urge to start learning the piano? Or,
yeah, huge. Yeah, I got to afford a piano.
But didn't
first.
Do it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Maybe you can bring one of those back on a cart or something. So the book is out now. It's called The Lost Pianos of Siberia. And obviously we all know where to buy books these days, but where can we get it?
Yeah, it's only come out recently, and it's getting some really fun critical attention. And the independent news bookshops are really supporting it, which is exciting, because it's a book that, once you get into it, I hope you it's understood as, yes, it's a little bit eccentric, but it is, I hope it'll have the reputation of a hand-on, I read this, have you tried it, kind of reputation.
And we can get it in all the usual places.
Yeah, you can, yeah. It was in all the rest, yeah.
My last question is always about music, because I always believe that music goes hand in hand with travel. And actually we were saying then, you know, it's the urge to not sit on your phone and to watch the trees go past when you're on the train, but a lot of people will still listen to music. And if you had to pick one song that reminded you of a special or memorable, for any reason, time and place of travel, what is that song and why?
Okay, this is so unpopular. and it came out of an experience in Russia when I was in a town called Tobolsk, which is like the quintessential Russian picture postcard. You know, it's golden couplers on a white Kremlin, the snow falling softly, and this Russian priest started to help me with something I needed some help with. And he took me into the back door of this seminary where he gathered 12 or so of his friends, and they sang in their cassocks Russian choral music, which is non-instrumental, with the deepest, most spine-tingling music. It is amazing. And if I ever want to feel good and I want to feel that gratitude for being alive, so in my high points of travel, I'll turn on a Russian male choir.
We haven't had one of those before on the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting to us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much, Sophie, and indeed thank you for listening to the Big Travel Podcast. Coming up, we have Travis Elborough with truly fascinating tales from the world's vanishing places, and also best-selling author Victoria Hislop.